It's snowing in April. Really? All right, I'll get to that in a minute. Hey, I want to thank everybody who came out to see me at the Improv in West Palm Beach, Florida last weekend. It was a great, great weekend. Had some sold-out shows and just a blast with everybody. Took a bunch of pictures, which are on my Facebook page. Check it out. This coming weekend, if you want to check me out, I'm going to be in Albany, New York at the Funny Bone in Albany, Friday and Saturday, April 20th and 21st. And the following weekend, I'm going to be in Hartford, Connecticut at the Funny Bone in Hartford. So if you're in the area, come on out, hang out, take some pictures. Unless you get snowed in, because it's April, and that happens all the time now, apparently. There's no global warming. Please, what? I can't wait for May. Maybe we get some monsoons. This is not the way to live. Hey, by the way, let me take a minute to tell you about a great website because I've been using it. I'm stuck in with the snow and everything else. I decided to use deepdiscount.com. They have thousands of movies and TV shows, great prices. You click their logo on my homepage. It's right there, and you'll see what I mean. Be sure to look for special icons and coupon codes for even more savings. Look, don't waste time searching and searching to find your favorites, and they just, you know what they do? They put it in the new release row on the on-demand, and then they put it in the popular, and it's a repeat. I wasn't born yesterday. It's still snowing out, by the way. Look, there's no more commercials, no more edits or bad streams that buffer all the time. And that's if you can find something good. Go to deepdiscount.com and buy the shows you want to watch and own them forever. You'll find classics from back in the day. I just bought Slapshot. Great movie right up there with Caddyshack and Animal House. You find hard-to-find titles and new releases. Out this week, The Commuter, starring Liam Neeson, as a guy on a train who's not having a good day. He just got fired and now, on his commute home, gets pulled into a conspiracy happening on the train. Still sounds better than most of my commutes. Get your copy now on DVD and Ultra HD for a great price at deepdiscount.com. Just click their logo on my homepage. It's right there. You can't miss it. Be good to yourself. Buy your favorites and support my sponsor, too. It always helps, and that helps me keep putting out great podcasts and great guests. So I really appreciate it if you can go on there, click, check it out, and buy a little something. Check it out now. Thank you, Deep Discount. All right, my guest this week is Jason Hare. Has an HBO documentary out about Andre the Giant. Incredible. Great, great doc. And he spent a lot of time with people who knew Andre and gets into sort of the facts behind the myth. Really, really cool conversation, and you're going to hear some stuff that you never heard before about Andre the Giant and wrestling. So enjoy that, and hopefully we'll see you in Hartford, Connecticut or Albany, and go to deepdiscount.com, pick up a little something. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us again, and if you're a first-timer, where have you been? It's me, the guy whose name is on the thing. Really, really interesting guest today who has a fabulous documentary out about Andre the Giant on HBO. And I watched it. I can't recommend it highly enough. I'm here with the filmmaker of the doc, Jason Hare. How are you, buddy?
Jason Hare, yeah.
Didn't I get it right?
You did.
I did.
I've heard them all. It's a weird spelling, so I've heard every single
one. No, I know. What I did was I looked it up online to see how other people pronounced it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And then I wrote phonetically H-A-I-R on my
Yes, that's a good...
I didn't want to butcher it, man.
Yeah, I've heard them all. Substitute teachers can be...
Yeah. Well, good to have you. And we're fellow New Englanders. You grew up in Mass. I grew up in Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool to kind of talk to somebody from the area where I grew up in, and we were just talking about accents and how neither of us seem to have the New England. I don't have the Rhode Island. Although there's a couple of words like Florida and orange kind of give me away.
Yeah.
You know, most people say orange. And
some extra R sneaks in there. That's the weird part is that you lose the R in a lot of words, but right. I think subconsciously we put it back.
Put it
so
back
it's go to the car and get the pizza.
Right, exactly. I did that like
a vodka soda, or my dad for a while was going to yogurt.
That's hilarious. Yeah, I think subconsciously you're overcompensating for like sort of not being able to speak the English. When I talk to my mother and my sister, it is literally like just they
sounds like ducks.
Oh, exactly. It's like Paulie. Paulie, and it's always Paulie. It's never going to not be anything but Paulie, you know? And it's really, really great. Yeah, exactly. And then there's a lot of like, I told him, and it's just like, I don't even know half of what you're saying, and I lived with you like my whole life, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, Bill Simmons had Mark Wahlberg on his pod a while back. I it was probably for the Boston Marathon. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about how people do accents, Boston accents, well, and how they don't. And right. when you overdo it, it gets painful.
Yeah.
Like Martin Sheen in The Departed was some
of those
things.
And I also don't,
painful.
I don't, you know, Boston's a pretty cosmopolitan town. You know, it is possible that somebody who lives in Boston came from another part of the country and doesn't speak that way. Like, not every movie has
shocked.
To have every person, yeah. right? You know what I mean?
Like, but he was saying that it's more about the attitude than the drop in your R's. It's
right.
more about just this ubiquitous, like, you're sick of the weather, you're yeah. sick of the sports team.
You don't take any shit. You have no,
yeah.
it's so not it's, even a short fuse. You have no fuse at all.
It's really about, like, where are you going to lunch?
Yeah.
Where are you going? Like,
right.
what are you so angry at?
right,
it's
exactly.
about, it's more about the cadence and
right.
the tone rather
right.
than
and,
the,
and then it's not like there's no subtlety or nuance to disagreeing with somebody. Ah, you're full of shit.
Yeah.
What do you know?
No.
It's like
that's
that
it.
Whole thing.
It's black and white.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you mentioned Bill Simmons because Bill is the producer of your doc. And how did you come to sort of start to work with him and know Bill? I know you've, by the way, you were at HBO when I did a HBO comedy series when...
Bob Costas?
Well, Bob was there, but no, I did. I basically, it was called Got No Game, and I did it in the period when you were there, like around 2005.
Yeah, 01, 08, I was there.
Yeah, it was Rick Greenstein. Greenstein was number
Rick Bernstein.
Bernstein was number
and
two.
And Ross Greenberg.
And who
was
Ross Green, it was when Ross was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think we ever ran into each other or worked on anything together, but I worked with a guy, Tom. I worked with Kendall Reed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if she's still there, but... But yeah, it was great. We did it was a comedic sports series. So taking a look at sports. I'll send you a couple of links.
Yeah, they had for a while, they always wanted to have comedic bits at the end of episodes of Inside the NFL.
Yeah.
And we used to do, I worked on Bob Costas' show, which was on the record and then later on called Costas Now. And they were always trying to fit. That was also around the time that Chris Albrecht was running HBO. And he was a former stand-up, so he had his feet deep in the
right,
comedy water
right.
and was always trying to imbue all the programming with...
Right, and I came out of The Daily Show, which essentially did, for news, what you can do with sports, which is to take the headlines in sports, especially the stuff going on off the field, and skewer it in a smart, funny way. Be funny, but make a comment with it, you know?
Yeah, you guys rewrote the book on that.
Yeah, a little bit, I guess. But that was the thing, like, so that was kind of the point of it, and we did a bunch of episodes, and we went to the Hatton Pacquiao fight out in
Vegas,
yeah. And that was really boy. If you, when you walked around that fight, you would have thought that because the Hatton fans were so loud and the Pacquiao fans are so demure and quiet,
yeah.
you would have thought that Hatton was going to just take it and run and whatever. And he had already won, and
yeah.
then it was just
all bark, no bite.
Yeah, and then we were shooting during the fight, and then he. I guess second round maybe started to rock him and like, guys, we got to get this because he's going to knock him out.
He looked that's one of the more violent knockouts I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
That's the one where Ricky ended up on his back in the middle of the ring after the knockout, but his momentum took his arms over his head.
Oh, right.
And he was unconscious with his arms over his head in the middle of the ring, like perfectly placed. If you placed a dead body in the middle of the ring, that's where you would put it. And that's where he ended up. Like Floyd knocked him out too.
Yeah.
But Floyd took 10 rounds to just beat him mercilessly.
Yeah.
And finally put him down
yeah.
in the 10th. This was, I think, a second or third round knockout.
It was insane. I mean, I met guys that came all the way from being like middle class guys that spent like thousands of dollars to come for the fight.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
and
they were loud.
He's
and
a folk hero over there.
Oh,
he's Manchester. We spent, so that was my last big project that I did at HBO for the 7 years that I was there. We did a 24/7 on Floyd Mayweather and Ricky Hatton. So I spent a lot of time over in Manchester with Ricky's family and with him and with his friends and where he came up. He came up in a council estate, which is basically a housing project, we would say here.
Mm-hmm.
But the council estate is where he grew up and we interviewed him back there.
Oh, cool.
And the fans there are just rabid.
Yeah.
Rabid.
Yeah.
You take Sox Yankees and you multiply it by 1,000.
We talk
about their soccer fans and their boxing fans, any combat sport whatsoever. You go to a pub in Manchester at night, you're walking into
right.
a combat sport.
They were drunk. They didn't care. They were walking around the hotels in Vegas and, they sang that song. Oh, Ricky Hatton.
Yeah. We had to clear. So there's only one Ricky Hatton walking along, singing a song, walking in a hat in Wonderland was the song. We had to clear the rights to Winter Wonderland for 24/7 because you're not allowed to. You can't just use a song and co-opt the lyrics, but keep the
actual
tune,
song,
the melody.
The melody.
you owe the person who wrote the song wow. money. So even if it's inadvertent, you know, we're filming with him and his fans break out into that song. Now the meter's running and you want to tell these people shut up because it's not adding to the,
I know.
I mean, if someone comes by and is playing Stairway to Heaven on their boombox, your show's gone.
Right. Exactly.
It's over.
I did a piece with Michael Buffer out there and he gave me one, let's get ready to rumble, but he charges like
$15,000
or something, but you know, he liked me and we hit it off. And I'll send you a couple of pieces. I think you get a kick out of it because he kind of showed a side of himself, which I was excited about that. But let's get into the doc a little bit because it's really, really cool. I watched it. There's a lot that jumps out for me. And, you know, there was something that I think really kind of more than anything else, stood out in terms of, just where you wanted to go with this and what you wanted to do. And did you feel like you said in an article, our culture has an appetite for stories that are truly larger than life. I heard so many stories about Andre, but none of them were true. My goal is to tell the story of Andre Rusimov. Am I pronouncing
it? Rusimov.
Rusimov, the human being, not the giant or the carnival attraction. And I really think you did that. Was it difficult to sort of get down that road with access to people and sort of what you had to work with, given that you didn't have the actual subject alive to talk to?
That was the unique challenge in this one. Not that he was dead, because I've done pieces about people who are no longer with us.
Yeah.
The unique challenge in this was that none of the basic facts about him that we looked up, that you have the luxury of looking up now, or if you're doing something on, say, Roger Clemens, you can look it up and see that he lives in Katy, Texas, and he's got three sons, and their names all start with K, and it's like, okay, those are facts.
Right.
With Andre, there were no baseline facts. The first line in his Wikipedia page at the time that we started researching, I don't know what it is now, was that he was born in Grenoble, France, which is 6 hours south of where he's actually born.
Yeah, he was.
So even the most basic facts about him were wrong. Of course, his height and weight was exaggerated and fluctuated all over the map.
300, 500, 490.
380. I mean, the only time that we had anything on record of him where he is out of character, because he hasn't even become the character yet, is that film that we have, that the footage that we have early in the doc, which is him when he's 19 years old and he says he's 309 pounds.
Right.
And there's no reason to believe that he's lying then. He almost seems like he's like sheepish when he's on camera, because it's probably the first time he's ever been on a camera.
Yeah, he's like a sweet young boy.
He was a kid.
Skinny, tall kid. Right, that's the other thing.
But super athletic and actually like a good-looking guy. This is before his disease morphed his features. He was like this kind of like matinee idol, chiseled face. And he was probably, I think he said he's 6'9 or 6'10 at that time.
Yeah.
309 pounds, which... he still looks skinny.
Oh, his baby picture is adorable. And when you started to move in on the baby picture, I'm thinking it's going to be this giant. He looked like just a normal baby. And I think it was when he hit, his brother said when he hit teen years, right? It really kind of, what's the disease called again?
Acromegaly.
Right.
So it's gigantism is the colloquial term for it.
And
so,
there's a myth that he had two hearts and all of this.
Well, we go over that, like the extreme mythology. Yeah. But even the basic mythology, which I believed, that you read in so many, even some of the reviews for this film were adopting those as facts, because they would, you know, the reviewer watches the movie and then looks up more facts about him, facts and quotes, and says that, you know, by the time he turned 12, he was 6'3", 200 pounds. It's just not true. There's so much falsehood out there about his childhood.
Right.
That we went back to the village where he was born, which is 40 miles outside of Paris, and it's a village of 40 people.
It's Moline, is that it?
Moline.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
There's about 40 people in this little village. It's probably, in the city, would say it's two blocks long. Mm-hmm. There's probably six houses. Mm. And it's on the outskirts of this tiny town called Oussy-sur-Marne, which is, you know, once you get, I'm not familiar with like French geography at all, and this is why it was a thrill to go out there and do this. You know Paris, and that's very metropolitan. Once you get a half hour outside of that, you're not just going 30 kilometers east. You're going back in time.
Yeah. I remember because my wife and I did our honeymoon in Paris, and then we spent some days in the countryside. Mm-hmm. And
it's beautiful.
But it changes.
But that's part of the allure of it, is that you get out there, and there's one restaurant in town, and no one speaks any English. Yeah. I'm talking about hi, bye, how are you doing? when you realize like how privileged an American you are. Like, they don't even know how to say, what time is it? Like, no.
Right.
And they don't care that you don't.
And in America, you could travel 3,000 miles and still be speaking the same language. Yeah. There you travel 30 miles.
Yeah, so it was great, actually, to do that and to meet the people who literally grew up with him. We went there armed with a stack of photos from his childhood and that his family had given us. Yeah. And we're knocking on doors and walking around, just stopping people on these dirt roads and saying,
really?
Do you recognize any people in these photos?
And you don't speak the language?
Not at all.
So did you have someone obviously
We had two translators, yeah.
Oh, wow.
The guy, Pat LaPrade, who's in the doc, the one who sounds very French and he's got glasses.
Right.
He is a wrestling historian and expert from Montreal. And we had been leaning on him just as a researcher. We hired him to help put us in touch with, because I knew that once we got the phone numbers for some of the family members, we needed to call them and explain what the project was. But we needed someone educated enough. I mean, our producers were literally going online and trying to figure out how to speak French when they were calling some of these places to get footage and stuff. I mean, that's how resourceful they are. It was like, all right, we're going to save money. Instead of getting a translator, we'll learn, we'll teach ourselves. So we hired Patrick, and then quickly realized like he knew the story as well as or better than we did. And I was like, why don't we just bring him? So we need someone to conduct these interviews in French.
Right.
And Patrick and I went over the X's and O's of exactly what we're trying to get these people to say and where we want to go with them. But I have no idea. I'm sitting there while he's interviewing Andre's brothers and I can't tell. All of a sudden the sister-in-law starts crying and I'm thinking, I guess they're talking about his death now. I had no idea.
Oh, wow. That's
and normally, you know, you can stop the camera and go down certain roads and take a break.
And also you have a script, but you're sort of off. You have to be ready to be off script. You can't be off script if you don't know what the answers are.
No.
You can't shuck and jive and move a little bit and improvise when you don't know.
I told those guys on that trip that, you know, I'm the quote unquote director, but I was the least important person on that trip because I don't know how to use the audio equipment or the camera.
Right.
I can't speak French.
Right.
I don't know the road, so I can't be the driver. There was nothing. All I could do was offer like my playlist
and we'd play
coffee,
maybe.
Seriously, I went back to being a PA.
Guy.
Yeah, seriously.
That's hilarious.
So I was just sitting off camera, you know, admiring the vistas and hoping that the interview went well. There was no reason for me to even be in the room.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because what you really were able to do was you really got a sense that this was just like a young kid. He was sweet. He was very conscious and got hurt when people would, you know, call him names walking through airports. As
when he got older,
When he got older. But the thing that's the paradox for me is, you know, and he was very aware and self-aware of his size and the effect he had on people. And yet he chose the most public way to get. I'm sure he could have been smart enough to do a clerical job or whatever, or put roofs on or paint houses. And to me, it was almost noble and heroic in a way for him to put himself out there in front of thousands and millions of people
for
so many years and lean into it as opposed to sort of hide. What was that about? Because it just seemed to rub against how sensitive he was, and I would be too, about how big he was and how he, as it's pointed out in the doc, didn't really fit any. For Christ's sake, his mother had to make a chair for him because there's furniture. There's that shot of him holding the Molson can.
Oh, that's the classic one.
It's crazy.
Which I even thought, mythology of this.
Is that a prop? But it's not a prop.
I thought it was, because I had only seen the tight shot of that. I hadn't seen the wide master shot of it, which that's Terry Todd's hands on the other side. That's the guy in the dock with the white beard, who's a fantastic interview for us and really connected a lot of dots.
Yeah.
He is sitting there with him and said, like, impromptu to this photographer, you should take a picture of this. And I had always thought, you know, those little Coke cans and people like take pictures of like the 8 ounce ones instead of the 12. This is a legitimate 12 ounce.
Yeah.
So when people talk about him drinking 100 beers, it's not that implausible.
Right.
But back to your question, he kind of fell into this in a way that was, we could have done an hour and a half on just 0 to 18 of his life. Because there was so much to mine.
Right, he was playing rugby soccer and then rugby.
According to him, and you even have to vet what he says, because he was the one who perpetuated a lot of these myths. He's the one who every talk show he went on would say that he was from Grenoble. And the talk show host would say, what was that like? And he would talk about the mountains and whatever. All of the interview footage that we had of him and the guys that I mentioned to you before, Matt Maxon and Jake Rogal, they mined every frame.
So why was he saying he was from Grenoble?
He got a kick out of it. I think he got a kick out of perpetuating the myth. And a good psychiatrist.
Well, but just so people understand, this Grenoble just
Why Grenoble? His backstory was that he was discovered in the Alps, that he was a lumberjack discovered in the Alps.
Right, and his name
was based on Jean Ferret.
Jean Ferret.
Which is basically the French Paul Bunyan.
Right.
So he was supposed to be like, and then the play on words was Jean Ferré, which is Giant Ferré instead of John Ferré.
Right.
So he, though, embraced that mythology and said he was from there.
Yeah, he had like a lumberjack shirt and there's a shot of him.
Yeah, that's when he's 19, when he first came on the scene. Mm-hmm. That was when they were first introducing him in that. And that's one of those moments you get that footage and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
This is definitely making it in.
Yeah, exactly. So
he also, though, had said that his grandfather was 8 feet tall. That he comes from a long line of giants. He really got a kick out of perpetuating these myths. None
of
that is true.
It's funny because it's almost like he was bred to be a wrestler because he understands the Pinky Barnum aspect of it.
He absolutely did.
But he had no idea at that point that, I mean, he just, wrestling even existed for him because he fell into it because he was in a gym one day.
Yeah.
And they needed someone to step in to wrestle.
And even further than that, when you're 18 years old at that time in France and you're a male, you're forced to enlist in the French army.
Oh.
This is back in the early 60s.
Right.
I think he was 65 when he was 18. And when he went, this is one of the things that we didn't put in because we were just trying to, as quickly as possible, get you the nuts and bolts of his childhood and get him famous, get him to North America.
Yeah, because
now the fun can start.
There's so much there.
Because there's so many audiences we're trying to speak to. It's the casual fan. It's right. The wrestling nerd fan. It's someone who only knows him from The Princess Bride. Right. So, all right, who are we doing this for? Yeah. We were doing it for the wrestling nerd fan. We would have spent an hour in Moliere to show
no,
you.
No, I think it was good. I think there was a good balance. I can't say that I'm a wrestling nerd fan. I'm a fan, more of a casual fan. And my wife,
I say nerd affectionately, by the way.
No, no. And my wife is not at all. And she watched it with me and she found it really interesting.
Yeah.
And it was heartfelt.
It was tough. And there's always, it's ironic that any of these docs, sports or non-sports, the people who are the most invested in it and have the biggest interest in it are always the ones who are the biggest critics of it because they know the details so much. It's like saying, you know, did you read the book? The book was so much
better. Yeah, I know. Listen, I get that too. If I go on like CNN or Fox News and I say something, people start slamming. Everybody's got an opinion.
It's,
but you're not.
It's fine. You know what?
You can't.
If people
satisfy
are discussing
everybody.
It, I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
Obviously, you want it to be more good than bad. But if people are just, if it's on the radar at all, then that's great. So anyways, one of the stories we had to lose was that he's 18 years old, and he shows up at this like barracks or wherever you have to go to like register, and they didn't have any uniforms that fit him. And he ironically fell through the cracks. This is a 7 foot 18 year old who's falling through the cracks because otherwise he would have been in the army.
Andre the Giant would have been in the army if they had clothes that fit him. Wow.
And if anything, if I'm that guy and I don't have anything that fits him, I'm saying, all right, we got to get something that fits him because we got a giant who's going to fight on our side.
We got five guys wrapped into one right here.
But his brother told us that story. Those were the people who have no reason to lie, the people who aren't necessarily on the WWE payroll.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that I was the most interested in talking to.
Yeah.
And his brothers are so far outside of that orbit.
And why? Because you felt the WWE was going to sort of embellish things for...
I was wary of it. Yeah. I'm confident that most of the stuff that we put in there, and I'm sure like maybe Hulk is laughing somewhere right now thinking that he put one over on me, but I'm confident that most of the stuff that we put in there, because there's a lot that we did not
put
in.
Well, he seemed truly moved. I don't want to give too much away, but he seemed truly moved.
Give it away. I mean, people, that's fine.
Well, he starts crying when he talks about, you know, I mean, we can get to that in a little bit, but
we,
you know,
I took out, there's a moment when I got a sense that he was forcing himself to cry. So if you notice, we jump cut. His eyes are red, but that's not on purpose that I put it in there. His eyes are still red from, there's a moment where he says he called slam and then he called leg drop. This is the WrestleMania 3. And he didn't, I thought he was going to kick out and he didn't kick out.
Right.
And then there's like a 12 second awkward pause where he's just grabbing at the bridge of his nose in the Raw interview. And I'm thinking to myself like, all right, man, come on.
Yeah.
We're among friends. You don't have to do this.
Yeah.
Please don't do this.
Yeah.
I got the sense that this is him coming off of 10 minutes ago. He was telling us that he stuck Vicks VapoRub in his finger to make himself cry on the air when Andre was ripping his shirt off. And he didn't even get a chance to stick his finger in his eye because Andre jerked him so violently. I was skeptical of that.
Oh, okay.
There were other characters in the doc who clearly made themselves cry, not people who made the final cut, but people that we were interviewing who were clearly making themselves cry. And it was like, all right.
But why? I mean, you know, he's dead. Like, what do they get out of faking an emotion for this guy?
I think they're from that culture. They're from that ethos. And
once
their
the camera's
moment.
On,
the lights are on. And it's, you know, he meant so much to me.
Yeah.
Like, some people do feel that way. And that, like, one of the few times that I actually have gotten emotional during an interview was with Tim White when he got emotional.
Because he talks about not being with Andre when he died. Yeah, I thought he was really, really
that
compelling.
Was really those. That's that one of the guys, real. And I get that he's from that world. But that's not one of those guys who I think it would benefit for him to manufacture.
No, that to me, unless I'm a bad judge of character, that was real.
That's how I felt. And there's been a few times in docs that I've done in the past where your instinct as a compassionate human is to shut the camera off and go give this guy a hug and say, take as much time as you need.
But you really want
to. But
keep
you have to pause for 5 seconds, just count to five, and let the emotion that that person is feeling be conveyed to the audience.
Right.
Because if you're not letting the audience feel what this person feels, then you're not doing your job if you're in my seat. But it's an excruciating 5 seconds because you feel like a complete asshole. You're like, this person is, if you started crying right now, I'd say, Jesus, Paul, are you okay? Like, here's a tissue. But you can't with that. And we,
so just thinking of the Bucky Dent home run against the Red Sox, and it makes me cry.
Buckner for me.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, I can't even look at that footage still. But no, that's really interesting.
But if you let that go one frame longer, you would have heard me off camera say, because what he's saying for the viewers who haven't seen this is, I wish I could have been there with him. I was with him for his whole adult life, and then the one time I'm not, he died alone in a hotel room, and that's my biggest regret.
Right.
And what I said to him right after we cut in the doc was, you were there for him for so many years, Tim. You can't let yourself feel that way because you gave him. Well, I'm not trying to be magnanimous about this, this is when you know the interview is going well, is that you're just having a conversation with somebody. Yeah. And you
said that with the.
Yeah, that's in the thing. I mean, the guys who were watching it told me that that's when they got emotional, is then it became a conversation between two weepy adult men. It's like a therapy session. But those kind of people, and like his brothers, to get back to them, they told us, his older brother, Antoine, the guy with the mustache, and his wife, the sister-in-law, he told us the story of Andre, 18 years old, not fitting into that uniform.
Uniform.
And it struck me as 100% true. Why would he lie about that?
Yeah.
These people were unaware of the mythology that surrounded him. So we mentioned that, I don't know if you've heard of the Samuel Beckett story about him. There's a certain sliver of the population that watches this doc that has said, well, they better talk about Samuel Beckett in this and how Samuel Beckett used to drive Andre to school. Samuel Beckett, the Irish playwright, had a house down the street from Andre's family in that same village. The street that leads to the village from that town I told you about is called Rue de Samuel Beckett.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this thatch roof. It's got a plaque in front of it. It's a beautiful little French home. And Samuel Beckett was in here like writing some of the greatest plays of our time, right?
Yeah.
So the story goes that Andre, by the time he was 12, couldn't fit on the bus that brought him to school. And that Samuel Beckett lived down the road, and Andre's dad had helped Beckett build this cottage. And as a thank you to the dad, Samuel Beckett took Andre and his flatbed truck to school every day. And they would have these conversations.
They hauled them like cargo?
Yeah. Depends however you want to perpetuate the mythology, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay.
They put him on
the
back.
They tied him with straps,
with
like Jack the Beanstalk.
Seriously. And that they would talk about cricket. And that's where this friendship was born, out of this love for cricket, the both of them.
Right.
So I got a lot leading up of, well, you better talk about Samuel Beckett. And I was eager to do that. Of course, as someone in my profession, that's something that you want.
That's
an incredible story, which is exactly what it is. An incredible, not credible story.
So you researched it and did due diligence.
We asked the brothers. Who would know better than them? So
how the hell did this get prepared?
Well, what happened was that there's...
It's such a random thing to make up.
One is that... I think the birth of it, and you'd have to ask Andre, but I think the birth of it, he told Cary Elwes this on the set of Princess Bride. And Cary had no reason not to believe him, wrote about it in his book, and has often told that story. Mm. And then there's a couple of graphic novels that have come out in the last 10 or 15 years about Andre that illustrated literally that story of him driving in a truck with Samuel Beckett, this like young, enormous Andre. Andre was not enormous when he was young. He was normal size when he was 12. There was no bus that took these kids to school. There was no bus not to fit on.
So
they lived
Andre
2 kilometers from the schoolhouse. And what happened was the brothers looked at us like we were crazy. That's one of the times that I knew they were asking him, because I could hear the guy go, blah, 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 Samuel Beckett. Blah, 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 blah. I'm like, oh, shit, this is when we're actually going to get to it. And I thought he would like throw his hands up and be like, yes, wee, Samuel Beckett, drive
nice,
the car.
Great,
no.
Man.
No. He looked at his wife, and they both were like, huh? Samuel Beckett? And no idea what I was or what Patrick was talking about.
That's it.
So he said that we lived 2 kilometers from the school. We walked to and from every day, all the kids in the village, like a dozen of them, say.
Yeah.
And Samuel Beckett sometimes, just like any other farmer on his way to town, would stop and let them hop in his truck and give them a ride to school, which was in this little town. But Andre wasn't singular to Beckett.
But Andre was perpetuating it, because he said he told Carrie
that. Yeah, and this is one of those things. He also said that his grandfather was 8 feet tall.
Okay, so
I was saying before that a good psychiatrist could probably tell you why he wanted to separate Andre the character from Andre Rusimov, the human, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't even know if Andre did
But this gets back to what I'm saying. It's like, to me, if you start perpetuating those myths, like I'm so big that they had to put me in a flatbed truck and blah, 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 you're just feeding into the thing that's hurting you and making you feel marginalized and disconnected from the rest of the population. I would think you would want to be, both in terms of your career choice and how you conduct yourself, as normal as possible. And so
emphatic about that.
And yet, there's this quote of his about children, and he says, I try to be very soft with children. I don't want them to fear me. Often when I go to homes of people who have small children, the children will run from me, even though they have seen me on television. I understand it's a sad feeling for me. So like, he clearly understood the effect he had on people. I know you're not a psychiatrist and you didn't meet him, but you obviously know much more about his life than I do. Can you somehow resolve that conflict to me? Because I don't quite understand it.
I think he understood. I think he loved performing, and he inherently understood like the P.T. Barnum aspect that you said before. Even Hogan says in the doc, he got sports entertainment, which is what they now call wrestling. They've been open with it for decades.
Right.
Sports entertainment, not sports. Mm. He understood sports entertainment before any of us did.
Where did this love from, you know, because he just, when he was 18 in this gym and he just got asked to fill in as a wrestler, was that where the light went off and he liked it? Where did this love of the sort of the spotlight come
from?
Well,
he always wanted to get out of that little town and see the world.
Yes.
And I think he saw this as his ticket. There wasn't formal education then. He was building furniture. The way that he got to that gym was he was a delivery man. And one of the guys that he was delivering to, he delivered like groceries to people's homes and offices.
Mm.
He drove the truck. Mm. Samuel Beckett was nowhere to be found. Beckett was in the back.
Beckett and with a bottle of wine and cheese and everything else.
So he delivered groceries. This is according to his brother. And these are the guys who I feel are the keeper of the truth flame with him. Because again, like they're not even aware of the mythology.
Yeah,
they're just telling me facts.
There's no skin in the game.
So he delivered to this guy and the guy said, you're a pretty big dude. You should come work out with us. And he tried to do a little bit of boxing and wasn't very good at that. But he played rugby and he was in the gym with these guys and they were pro wrestlers. It was called Le Catch, was what you call pro wrestling back then. It was a very niche attraction. This was not something that I had also read things that it's sweeping the nation. And one of the books said that young French boys at that point, that thing, all they cared about was women and Le Catch. That's it. And it was like his brothers again were like, no, we knew nothing about it. But anyways, these guys identified him as a big dude.
Right.
And the story goes that one night there was a guy who was sick and they asked him to fill in. So he from what I understand, got a lot of acclaim from that one night. He was a hit. He was athletic. He could do whatever they asked him to do. And then promoters around France started traveling him in to the south of France. And there were big tournaments in the summer. And now he's traveling. Yeah. Now he's getting out of this world. He's no longer delivering
eggs and milk
to people.
He's smart enough to know that I can use this body as my ticket out into fame and fortune and whatever else. I have something that no one else literally in the world has.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And an innate sense of how to entertain people. And a feeling of accomplishment and pride and happiness in entertaining these people. You watch him before he made that heel turn in 87. All of the footage we have of him, he's always got a smile on his face.
Yeah.
And then the evil Andre and all that. And we go over like he didn't like certain guys.
Right.
But still, he took great pride in being the source of happiness. Because it's very rare for someone who's big in any sport, in any arena, to be a good guy if they're the biggest guy.
Yeah, and
Shaq was not seen as like the lovable.
Right. And for people listening, you mentioned before you made the heel turn, who don't know wrestling, what that means is you go, heel is the bad guy, the villain that people boo. But Andre, for most of his career, was the good guy. Was the good guy, which again is like you think the big guy would be the...
Now, he was a heel in Japan. That's one of the things we didn't get into really at all was the Japanese side of his life, because he was an enormous star over there.
Oh, really?
And he went...
What time frame is that?
He went there before he even came to North America, and then... Throughout his career, he was going back and forth. He would get loaned out by Vince Sr. and then later Vincent K. McMahon, the Vince that we know.
And Vince Sr. was smart enough. We're talking about Vince McMahon Sr., who's the father and built the empire of professional wrestling that his son of Vince McMahon runs now. He was smart enough to know not to oversaturate him. So he would use him in a market, then he'd stop, and then he'd loan him out somewhere else, and he'd loan him out somewhere, and I assume he had some kind of profit-sharing deal with whoever he was loaning him to. But Vince McMahon Sr. dominated, controlled the Northeast, which was the most powerful part. Most powerful region of professional wrestling at the time. And that's the other thing that's really cool about the doc is you educate people a little bit on the history of wrestling. Like, I didn't know it was regionalized like it was.
It was really like, I mean, I hate to make the comparison, but if you think of mafia families, that's what it was like.
Yeah, that's a good,
It was all over the country. There were anywhere from...
Only no smelling of garlic, other than that. Exactly.
No sleeping with fishes, although there were some stories in there that we didn't... Again, we couldn't... If there was a great story that we couldn't verify, it just sounded too ridiculous. Yeah. You have to... as they say, kill some darlings, you have to kill some babies, and you have to say, all right, that's not going to make it
in. Is there an objective standard for verification, just to get off on a little tangent here for a second, or do you need to get two independent sources to corroborate?
It's not like that. When you're talking about anecdotal evidence, and again, and I'm sure that some people would roll their eyes at this, but there's a fine line between being a journalist, I hope more than a fine line, between being a journalist and being a storyteller. So what we do is we're storytellers.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that we embrace fiction and just wittingly mislead people, or else there would have been twice as many stories, fantastic stories about Andre and the Doc.
Yeah.
But a journalist, I guess, could fact check it and get two or three sources before they run their material. Mm. With us, it was really, a lot of it was just a smell test of the course of the interview. Mm. Vince gets emotional at the end, and I've had plenty of friends of mine who said, come on, like Vince is that guy, he manufactured those tears. That's not the sense that I got in the interview. That was hour three of an interview that was supposed to go 30 to 45 minutes. And by the end there, I thought that he was really kind of opening up as much as Vince can.
I wasn't sure. Did you feel that he felt fairly genuine to me? I also think that I think the tears were real, but part of me also felt like, well, you could have helped him have a better latter half of his life too, in some way.
A lot of it is tied up, and this is really psychiatrist stuff.
Yeah.
But this is what I was fascinated by. A forthcoming doc about Vince McMahon and the McMahon family would be absolutely fascinating.
God.
And I think a lot of his emotion when he talks about Andre, and it was clear to me, made clear to me by others and by him personally when I was going through the vetting process of being the one that they approved to direct this, that this was a sacred story within their company, within their family.
The Andre story.
More than any other figure, that this was the most...
Why was it so sacred?
Well...
He was the key to the building of that empire?
There's that on the surface level, is that without Andre as the cornerstone back then to put Hogan over and to put this thing into the stratosphere, none of this happens.
Right.
So that he is, I think Vince would certainly put Andre on his Mount Rushmore of important people in that business. I think that it goes even further into it. A quick primer on Vince McMahon is that he was born in...
Senior. Are we talking senior?
No. We're talking about Vincent Kennedy McMahon.
The son.
When
right
he was
now.
A child, was Vinnie Lupton. That was his name. And he was in, it was in one of the Carolinas, I believe North Carolina.
But wait, Vince McMahon Sr., the old man, is
that's,
this who we talking
about?
That's
his biological father.
Right.
But Vincent Jr., he doesn't like to be called Jr., but Vincent Kennedy McMahon, when he was a child, was Vinnie Lupton. That was his name.
Why did he have a different name from his father?
Because his father divorced his mother, and he was raised by his mother.
Oh.
in not great conditions with a stepfather who did awful things to him, the limits to which we don't really know. Only Vince knows that. But he's talked about sitting on the coast in Carolina and looking at the ocean and talking about wanting to kill himself when he was a kid.
It's funny because at the end of that conversation, when you say, I have a facility to put bad things out of my mind, to disconnect from them.
And there was a much longer version of that entire story
arc. Answers a question for me in my mind. It's like that, there's got to be something deeper there because it didn't seem to warrant.
So here's what, what happened. And I haven't gotten a chance to talk about this yet. I mean, it's a whole other movie that I would love to make someday, but
that would be unbelievable.
There's a lot of obstacles there, mainly his trust and his willingness to go deep.
Well,
but
I think after he sees this, I think he should give you a shot.
Maybe.
I'll give him a call.
I'll text him. So his father, as he's about to remarry, lives in D.C. The second wife says, we're not doing this until you go down to Carolina and resolve this relationship you have with your children. I think there was another brother. I forget the details now because we abandoned this storyline so long ago. But Vince was not an only child and was not the only biological child of Vincent Sr.
So Vincent Sr. is being told to go down to Carolina.
You got to go down there and you got to meet with your kids.
His soon-to-be second wife.
Yes.
Saying,
hats off to her for even saying, we're not doing this until you actually resolve this with your kids. Because you have kids down there who are, you know, living in mental squalor, certainly. And I think that they were in, a trailer home. It just wasn't really...
You think there was, physical abuse and sexual abuse?
At least.
And that kind of thing?
Yeah. So, I mean, Vince himself in our interview said that he was going to kill this guy.
Man, and it had to be,
Yeah, it's so there was something there homework, that was that warranted... You know, deep hatred. So his father comes down and Vince is enraptured by this guy. He shows up in a fancy car. He's got a fancy suit on. Like, oh my God, this is my dad.
Vince is a teenager.
He's, at 13, he put him into a military academy. The dad put Vince into the biological dad, Vince Sr., put him into a military academy outside of DC.
He never met him.
Wow. And it was immediately. Idolize this guy, but this is his dad.
Yeah.
So he started bringing him into the office before he was 13 when he was a younger kid, and he would sit there and work the phones and pretend to arrange wrestling matches. He was completely enthralled by his father and the business itself.
Yeah.
To the point where he abandoned that old last name, Vinnie Lupton, and became Vincent McMahon.
That's amazing. He'd be such a great subject for that.
His father's relationship with Andre was very tight. And his father's adherence to that territorial, you know, don't infringe on other people's territories and everyone's going to cooperate and run their family business. Because a lot of these were family businesses. The Crockett territory, you hear about all these guys.
Yeah, there was one. There was a Florida territory. There was an Alabama. And then it was in the
Midwest.
And most
of the time, one man or one family ran those territories. Mm-hmm. And they all got along really well. Now,
and they'd
Vince
Sr.
was the Don
other.
Of Dons.
Mm-hmm. But now let me ask you something. Did Vince McMahon Sr. have a contract with Andre in a sense he was in his stable like a Don King or
depends
whatever?
Depends who you ask, but it was certainly tacitly implied.
Because I'm a comedian, right? I go from club to club to club.
Yeah.
Their territories.
Yep.
But nobody owns me or tells me where I can and can't work.
I think it would be the equivalent of like your manager was booking you around. I mean, certainly his dad started booking Andre, and depends who you ask how much he got of a cut.
Yeah.
Vince, in our interview, said that his dad got nothing. It was just cachet, political cachet and prestige. Mm. When you ask other people in the industry, they say, of course, he was paid a cut of this.
Okay, yeah.
So he was very tight with Andre. He recognized that Andre could be a major North American, a major U.S. star, because Andre was already a North American star in Montreal and started slowly coming down to the territory.
So it was Europe, then it was Japan, and then it migrated
and
to
then
the
Montreal.
Regions, and then Montreal, then and migrated then, to the regions, which then migrated to Northeast, which then became the U.S.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, and they were very tight. Now, when Vince Sr. dies, and Vince Jr., quote unquote, the Vince we know, took over the WWF, this is before Vince Sr. died, he died of cancer, and Vince Jr. had already started going in and taking over these territories, which was sacrilege.
Things.
Well, not buying out, but he was putting them out of business because he used cable and syndication to put his programming on in their markets and essentially kill their program.
Yeah.
And the guys in their markets saw that he had national reach and they wanted to come work for the WWF at the time.
The rest.
So he was draining these guys. He wasn't going in and actively taking them over, but it was like, hey, there's a much bigger show in town and we're going to go with this guy, which was a no-no. It was sacrilege in this culture that every no one messed with anybody else.
It is like the mafia. It's like you don't.
It really was. And his father was the leader of this culture that you don't infringe.
So this is the old way versus the new way.
Yes.
The new way does it. It's so like Mike. It's like Michael Corleone. And
so this is a guy who, you know, thousands of people revered Vince Sr. But by the time he died, the McMahon family name was really resented all over the country. And that was the doing of Vince McMahon that we know.
Resented by the industry or by fans as well? You think the fans understood that dynamic?
I think the fans enjoyed the product. I think they were the ones who were
right.
consuming
so they didn't
it.
Understand they didn't consume. That, they didn't understand the inappropriateness of what was going on and didn't care.
Yeah, or if they did, they didn't care because yeah. it wasn't lining their pockets either way. They yeah. just wanted to watch something fun on Saturday morning. And,
yeah.
and it happened to be a better option here with yeah. more production value and better characters and new guys instead of seeing the same person over
right.
and over every week,
right.
winning the title every week
right.
in a high school gymnasium. They had a show at Madison Square Garden they were watching instead.
Yeah.
And this was all, I mean, Vince is a visionary, and this was all on purpose, that he wanted to take over everybody.
He understood that there was a demand.
Against the wishes of his dad. So his dad goes from being this revered, angelic figure to, by the time he dies, the McMahon family name is resented all over the country, right? Mm-hmm. Also, Vince is now the one who's booking Andre and managing Andre's career. And Andre used to love going from town to town and being the conquering hero. He had all the restaurants he liked to go to, all the bartenders he knew, friends right. in every town. He loved that aspect of his life.
Right.
That wasn't there anymore. Because all he had to do was tape a show in Allentown and tape a show in Madison Square Garden or regionally in the Northeast, and it was beamed out to everywhere.
And did he miss that life?
Yes. He
felt isolated?
Yes. So he...
Is this when he bought a farm in North Carolina? Is that
he bought that farm in 79, so it right. didn't. It wasn't exactly that chronology, but
he liked
that. And
he loved people, and he liked being on the road
yes.
and going into the small towns, performing, and then going on afterwards and being the big man
exactly.
on campus.
Exactly.
No pun intended.
Exactly. The enormous man.
the
on man.
The enormous.
So, and Vince Sr. though was the proprietor of that life for him.
Yeah.
So then, when Vince comes in and takes over and takes him off the road, essentially, and also kind of sullies the family name.
Yeah.
All of this is tied up. And we've already said that Vince adored and admired his father.
Mm.
So by the time his dad died, I think he thought, and this is my guess, I think he thought that he realized what he had done to his father's reputation. And Andre resented Vince as well. It depends who you talk to. We talked to plenty of people who Vince said that they had a great relationship and it deteriorated when Andre got really sick and couldn't be used anymore, and Vince had to kind of put him out to pasture.
Mm.
There's other people we talked to who said that he resented him from the moment that he took over.
Because of the way he was selling the Vince Sr. name, or because he kind of took him off the road and locked
both
him
of
away.
Those things. Mm. And who knows about their interpersonal.
But Andre's an adult. Can he say no? He's got all the leverage with Vince. There's no other Andre. Look, I'm a comedian, right? There's a gazillion of us. If I say no, I mean, you know, there's another one that you can replace me with, whatever.
But where are you going
to
go?
But my point is this. Why can't he say to him, look, I want to continue to go around the country. You're going to have to put me into some arenas, more than one or two.
Because say you want to go to...
San Diego. I don't know.
Yeah, you want to go there. The club closed. Because you're performing at a club in New York and they're beaming your show to San Diego on TV. That club closed.
Yeah.
So there's no...
I can't do those shows anymore. I can't
anymore.
Do their version of Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, there is none.
There is none.
So
he resents
all of this
him
is wrapped up
and
now.
And you seem to believe that he did kind of resent him, and it was not
yes.
as lovey-dovey as Vince Jr.'s.
I don't think there was a hatred there, but I think that Vince probably wanted to be accepted and liked by Andre as much as his father was.
Right.
And also that this was a huge cornerstone of his business, and he had to have at least a cordial professional relationship with him.
So it sounds like Andre, his feeling about Andre and how that's a sacrilegious story is because it's really, it's got his father, it's tied to his father.
So this is
way.
Now we fast forward to him starting to cry.
Yeah.
As we ask him, do you remember where you were when you heard the news that he died? Or do you remember the last time you spoke to him? And that's when Vince said, I have a capacity. If something hurts me, I just put it aside and don't deal with it.
Right.
And this is someone, imagine the amount of repression. And the final question was, did Andre's passing affect you more than other passings? And the longer version of that question we edited down was that you've seen a lot of your wrestlers pass away before their time on your watch. And the inference there is by natural or
unnatural. Almost like the NFL with concussions to me. That's what I was thinking.
There's a big moral reckoning that that we had to do as fans, now let alone people who run that business.
And what did he say to that?
He saw the response.
Well, you know why I thought the end was real, his reaction, was because you asked the question and he was looking away and he went, what?
He's almost pissed off.
Yeah, I didn't feel like it was manufactured. Well, I felt like either he was, I mean, I just, as the viewer, I can't remember what the question was.
The question was, did his passing affect you more than other passings? And he said, more than what? Like, I thought he was going to, like, leap across the table at that point, because now this guy's had it. We're on our third hour, and I told him to go 45 minutes.
See, I read it that he was just on another thought. He was getting so emotional inside that he just couldn't focus, and he needed the question repeated.
Yeah.
Maybe you were in the room. Maybe you read it like he was going to come across.
No,
he's an intense guy.
No, I didn't. I mean,
I thought the tears were real.
I thought the tears were real because he tried to stifle them. Whenever someone... I can't stand, whether it be in a sporting event or a doc or a movie or anything like that. Mm-hmm. If someone's letting a tear trickle down their face and they're not wiping it away, get the fuck out of here.
I love it, man. That's exactly what I
know. No person on the planet doesn't do that unless they're performing.
Yeah.
It's an annoying thing on your... Yeah. It's not that you should be ashamed of crying, but it's an annoying thing to have a substance flowing down your face.
Well,
and you're
Terry was really fighting. That was real.
Vince or Hogan?
White.
Tim White.
Tim.
Oh, yeah.
Terry.
No, this was...
That's a guy. That's crying 101. If you really
when someone's
cry.
Swallowing back tears and trying to kind of like shake it off like that, to me is genuine because that's what a human being does is they start to panic and
you
and
felt
stifle that
and therefore
response.
You felt Vince, which I did, was genuine because you could tell he was trying.
This is a guy who you're not allowed to. I was warned. Sneeze in front of him.
Why?
That's his thing. He's so alpha that if you sneeze in front of him, you've lost control. And A, he just thinks that that's a beta move. And B, don't get me sick. So,
are you serious?
Don't sneeze in front of Vince was one of the suggestions to me. So I loaded up on fucking Claritin.
Yeah, I was gonna say, get all your sneezing out outside
seriously.
In the waiting area.
But so this is a guy who doesn't sneeze, and there's a big snort that he does as he's trying to kind of compose himself. And I'm thinking, all right, this is a guy who cares about his image and control as much as possible.
Like that?
Yeah, so he's like does this, and it's kind of this like snotty. Mucus nosed thing. And I thought, like, all right, if he did that, then that's involuntary because this is a guy who comes in with a perfectly tailored suit and his hair done and a makeup artist. If he's making that noise on camera, it's because he lost control for a split second.
Right.
And there's still people. I talked to a buddy of mine today who said, I don't buy it. This is a guy who is a sociopath and has made money off the backs of these guys who died. And this is a performance and you got,
well, that was the only reason why I felt, I don't know. I think it was genuine because, man, otherwise he's an incredible actor. But I did, the only part of it was, like I was saying, as if you were like, the guy was 43. He was
46.
Clearly 46 when he died. He clearly had issues, physical issues. You could have helped him. You could have given him a job in the office, like whatever. You know, you could have made him an ambassador. Exactly. His own elevator.
Carrying you up to your office.
Giving you lunch. It'd be bringing you groceries. It'll be a throwback to when he was 18 and 19 in his hometown in France.
Building you furniture.
And did you, there's a this mention in sort of looking into this and researching a little bit about social media today and whether Andre could have been Andre today, because there was a mystique, right? Like he came into a town and then he left and when would the giant be back? Where if you started to see him all the time on social media, maybe is that the idea that maybe the mystique and the myth wouldn't have been able to be.
It wouldn't have been
powerful?
Diminished. It wouldn't have been diminished. It would have been eliminated.
Yeah.
There would be no mystique.
Yeah.
Because if he drank 106 beers with Ric Flair, there'd be an iPhone video of it and it would be on TMZ tomorrow.
Yeah.
If not later today, like right when it happened. So you had, this is pre-internet, pre-cable in the 70s.
Right.
The only method you had of hearing about this guy were wrestling magazines and pictures and possibly going to see him in person.
Right.
Then he shows up on $6 Million Man in a Sasquatch costume. That was a big deal. Now, this is a little bit before my time, but I remember my older brother, Paul.
I don't remember this.
This was in 76, I think he was on. So Paul was about 6 years old, and he says that he vividly remembers watching $6 Million Man and that Andre came on in a Sasquatch outfit. That was a big episode.
Jeez.
So you only had a really, and there's three channels too. There's no ESPN. There's no
ABC,
wrestling isn't national
CBS,
yet.
NBC, right?
You only have so many people from Boston have told me, like, I remember seeing him at the Garden Like he came and he would come to these places once a year.
So I remember seeing wrestling at the Rhode Island Auditorium,
yeah,
which was a precursor to the Providence Civic Center.
I was going to say it's a Civic Center, right?
And it had like literally, and you see hockey there.
Yeah.
And it would have like cages. Like it didn't have plexiglass. It just had cages and it was hot and there was
like
no
fencing?
Air
conditioning.
Huh?
Like fences instead of a boards?
Yeah, no, but not
boards?
But not as flimsy as a chain link fence. Think of a chain link fence, but like three times the thickness.
Okay.
So you can't move it.
Yep.
Like literally like a steel fence, steel. And it was like that. The holes were that big.
Yeah.
Right? And I just remember sitting there with my dad and everybody smoking and it was like right out of like a
movie,
yeah. Right?
Everything smells
and
like stale beer.
I remember seeing Bruno Sammartino and like these guys. And
it reminds me of the old Garden. You go in there and it's hot as hell.
Yeah. I remember seeing the Celtics.
Everything smelled like that. If I could smell it right now, that stale beer smell and the popcorn smell.
Yeah. And
the weird kind of lighting and everything's kind of hazy because smoking in the hallways.
Yeah, and the humidity.
You just feel like you're at this like underground event. Meanwhile, Larry Bird's 60 feet from you.
I know, exactly.
And everything in the Garden was on top of it. It was vertical.
I remember being it was one of the playoff games and Bird hit a shot. And my father was not an emotional guy. But I'll never forget this until the day I die. And we were in the upper deck.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember he hits this shot. And I never heard my father yell like this. He just went, yeah! And everybody stood up. And the entire deck starts moving.
Oh, yeah.
Like swaying up and down. Like it was crazy.
The Garden was notorious for that, too, is that you felt like it was going to crumble down.
Yeah,
and then there were seats. There were obstructive view seats that we were behind a pole, and that was it.
Right,
so you pay like $3 for this seat, but you're staring at a pole the entire time. When I was a kid, I was the ball boy for BC, the basketball team.
Cool.
When I was 9, 10, and 11, because my mom worked there forever.
Oh, that's
I used to go over and just hang out in the gym, and I got to be friends with like the coach and some of that. I called a meeting with the basketball coach, Jim O'Brien, at the time, and called him in his office and asked if I could set up a meeting and went down with like this proposal for this is why I should be the ball boy for the team.
Oh,
like,
man.
This is why I'm qualified to wipe up the sweat of 19-year-olds who've fallen on the floor. And I made my little pitch. My mom was waiting outside in the car. It was like, I mean, she was great to even let me do that.
That's
it was cool. And I'll never forget it. He stood up and said, Jason, by all means, yes. And he stuck his hand out like, I got the job.
That's
for zero pay, no nothing.
Oh, that's awesome.
My compensation was that I was allowed to come to the practices and any of the bus trips they would take me on. All the home games.
Oh,
and if it was a bus trip, they would take me to Providence, to UConn, to Holy Cross.
Yeah.
They treated my dad and I like royalty for the Big East tournament a couple of years down in New York. We came down on our own dime, but they gave us like the run of the joint in the Garden. So, in the Madison Square Garden. They used to play their home games in those days, though, in the Boston Garden.
Mm.
So this is around that same time that I'm going and experiencing, you know, the sights and smells of the Garden. Now I'm going in there 3 hours early, and they're putting the parquet down because the Bruins have just played.
Oh,
every other Saturday night, the Eagles would have a home game against some Big East team.
Yeah.
Because John Thompson, coach of Georgetown at the time, said, I'm not playing in the Roberts Center. I'm not playing in that place. 1,200 people.
Oh,
we're going to play in a real arena. And they said, all right, we got to get the Garden. So I would go in and be able to shoot around. This is at the height of the Celtics.
Oh, my God.
This is 86.
Oh, my God.
And I would shoot around by myself on the parquet for an hour.
I'm going to punch you in the face.
It was incredible.
Jesus.
I remember.
You were on the parquet, bouncing the ball.
Every other weekend. And then at halftime,
I
would go.
Is it creaky? Does it like, do you
hear? Very. And you can fit quarters in between the blocks of parquet.
Really?
And then. There was this guy, it's like, if you told me now it was a ghost and the guy never existed, it was like that ethereal. There was a guy who was this old janitor and he would come out and sweep the floor. And he would come out and he recognized me and every week we would talk, every other week we would talk. And he would show me where the dead spots in the parquet were. And like Dennis Johnson used to lead guys when he was guarding them over to these dead spots because he knew as soon as they dribbled the ball in that spot, the ball wasn't going to come back up.
And it's like the Harlem Globetrotter with a gag ball.
Yeah, but he would know that the ball wasn't going to bounce back up as efficiently, and he would swipe it then.
Wow.
He showed me this trick, this guy that Bird figured out, which is you stand at half court, and if you throw the ball up, and it just nicks the bottom of the American flag and lands on the foul line when it comes down, it bounces in swish every time. So every weekend I would practice that. It was incredible, man.
Wow. And that sort of
So I've been training for this job, like dealing with athletes, and
I was going to say
from the time I was little, I was in locker rooms and you know, just kind of like one of the guys from the time I was incredibly lucky to be brought up in that and to have this interest as well. Like everything kind of the stars aligned because I cared about sports and movies. Those are the two things and music.
And did you, what was your major in college?
English. I went to Williams. It was liberal arts.
Yeah. And then so, but did you know then that sort of?
I wanted to be a sport. I wanted to be either Bob Lobel.
Mm. Oh yeah.
Who was like Channel legendary. Four. Yeah.
Yeah.
I
Bob Lobel is a famous Boston local sports caster there for years.
Yeah. Yeah. I started.
We had Chris Clark, and Chris Clark was a guy, and he had these big jowls. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he this is Chris Clark. And when he would talk, his jowls would move, and he was a little chubby, but he was like
no R whatsoever in his last name.
No, no, no. Chris Clark.
Yeah. So Lobel, I started a newspaper, quote unquote, in sixth grade called the Sixth Grade Globe, which is two pieces of paper stapled together because I wanted to interview him.
Man, you're entrepreneurial at a young age.
I'm sure it was an assignment from our teacher or whatever, but the first edition of it, the Sixth Grade Globe, Horace Mann Elementary in Newton, Massachusetts, I was in charge of interviews. Like there was going to be a column that was just an interview column every week. And it was like interview the gym teacher or whatever. Yeah. I was like, fuck it, I'm calling Bob Lobel. My mom was the one who said, I said I wanted to interview him. She said, call him. I said, I can't call him. What are you talking about? She said, why not? Call him up and do it. So it was like.
You just called the station?
I called WBZ.
Wow.
And I asked for Bob Lobel. And the next thing you know, it would be like if today, like, be like, call Santa Claus. Just call him.
Just
like
call
it
him.
Didn't exist that that was a real human being outside of my TV. So he was on the phone and I said that I was a reporter from the Sixth Grade Globe in Newton. And I wanted to come interview him. And I'll never forget, it was Monday. I called him on a Friday and he said, okay, Monday at 4:00. And my grandmother brought me over after school and we saw Liz Walker in the lobby. And I was like, oh my God, that's Liz Walker. Like the 6:00 news lady. But I thought she was like, you know, Cher.
Yeah.
and he did the interview with me on the set of People Are Talking, which was hosted then by Tom Bergeron. Oh. Now like the Tom Bergeron of Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
And I interviewed him for 20 minutes and ran a column called 20 Minutes with Bob Lobel with such hard-hitting questions as, what is your favorite food? Which was pizza.
All right, there you go.
What do you think of hockey fights? And we went into that. And
good questions, though.
It was a
You're
wide
how old at this point?
I was 11.
That's incredible.
Wide-ranging interview.
No, but it's funny. I was just saying this the other night about the podcast, and one of the reasons I do it is so fascinating, and I told you off air, it's like, I think people should, I like to know about process, and I do this because I want people to hear about people that they haven't heard of who have, like yourself, maybe, you know, not a household name, but a great filmmaker and have a great history in this business, and also stars that they think they might know. But you can point to almost every interview that there's something in the childhood that tells you that this person's going to do what they do.
Yeah.
Bob Costas says he would lie in bed at night in St. Louis as a kid and listen to Jack Buck on the radio and his transistor radio.
Yeah.
And he was more enthralled with the announcing than he was the game.
Yeah.
And he kind of started to know that. And that clearly
I worked with Bob for years and still am
great
friends
guy.
With him. Fantastic guy and was incredibly good to me. He's the one who got me to HBO.
Oh, wow.
So we're not having this conversation if not for Costas.
So where
I was at NBC for 3 years. I was a PA and
on Costas.
Just for everything for NBA and
So you'd run it. You run into him and
Wimbledon
start,
and yeah. And I one of the guys that I worked for was a guy named Bruce Kornblatt, who was local radio royalty in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Grew up in Newton as well.
Oh, okay.
And they kind of put me under Bruce's wing, and Bruce was Bob's, you know, best friend and producer. And Bruce was a radio guy. So he would rely on me to get the footage and help out with music. And I kind of learned how to do the arts and crafts part of this just because he didn't want to deal with it.
Right.
And to me, it was a thrill to sit there with an editor and like choose what song we put underneath this part of the interview or whatever.
Yeah.
So when Bob went to HBO, that was my third year. It was right after 9/11. It was my third year at NBC. He said, do you want to come over and help on this show? So I moved over to HBO and he had... And then I was there for 7 years and then started doing my own thing. Ten years ago.
He did a sketch for me where he interviews me as the asterisk, the most powerful, because I still think
like it's the
most powerful
the thing.
The most powerful thing in sports. I'll send you a link. This was part of the HBO series we did when Ross was there. And he came in, looked at the script a couple of times, and just nailed it. It was like,
he's a funny dude. And he's also one of the smartest guys I've ever met in my entire life. Yeah. One of the best writers I've ever met. And one of the few writers, the only writer I've ever met who literally just does it off the top of his head. He's not a big typist. So he would, Aaron Cohen was kind of his protege or his, now Aaron is the most powerful writer in sports TV and beyond. Mm-hmm. If there's six nominees for best writing at the Sports Emmys every year, Aaron is five of those. Mm-hmm. He's incredible.
Yeah.
And a really good friend of mine. Bob would just walk around the room and off the top of his head dictate this perfectly written paragraph. And I've never met anyone who could really do that.
So those sort of, those insightful, deep sort of wrap-ups you see maybe?
Those are either Aaron's doing and Bob edits it. But if Bob, like there would be times when it was something that was really close to his heart or like something had happened that day that we had to talk about news-wise, we were on weekly. And we tried to go live whenever we could.
Yeah.
When he needed to flex that muscle, it was impressive.
Yeah.
And he came to rely on Aaron more and more. I mean, Aaron and I started out as PAs together. And I kind of went in one direction with the production stuff, and Aaron went in the direction of writing.
But you've learned at the feet of some amazing people.
Oh, incredibly lucky.
And now you're doing exactly what you knew you were going to, or thought you might want to do when you were 11, which is you loved movies, you loved storytelling, you loved sports.
That's all we did as brothers. I have two brothers, Paul and Brandon, and I'm the youngest of three.
Mm-hmm.
So we were 12, 9, and 6. We were separated by 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And all we would do is play sports or make movies. When we got one of those old school VCRs that you like have to put over your shoulder the cameras attached to.
Yeah.
And I wonder why I have herniated discs in my lower back now. It's because I was running around like lopsided as a kid.
Body's trying to develop, you're like shit out of it.
I was 8 years old when we got that thing. And all we used that for was to make movies of each other, and we would rotate. So one guy holds the camera, the other guy is
what we know now is the director. You could point to every person's childhood, and there's the thing. So you're making docs with your brother at 8.
We would do little things to make each other laugh. And that was one of the only times that they would let me play with them. So I recognized the value of like, all right, I'm needed to hold the camera. They have a great idea. They were very, very funny, but they need someone to hold the camera.
Yeah.
And they'd be doing this thing. It was really funny. And I would start to giggle holding the camera. They'd be like, shut up. And then it would cut out. And you hear me screaming upstairs, like, I'm telling Mom. And just now there's just one guy on camera.
It's like a jump cut
to me having gotten the shit kicked out of me in the interim. But so we used it for that. And we used it to tape hockey fights. So we would rotate, my brothers and I, holding the pause button down on record and watch every Bruins game. And anytime it looked like there might be about to be a fight, take our finger off the pause button. So you go through these tapes and it's just whistle after whistle of guys grabbing each other. And then like one out of every 10 whistles is like, and here we go. They dropped the gloves.
Oh, yeah. I hope you still have those somewhere.
Somewhere, man. And we also thought this is pre-internet. So we thought that we were the only ones doing this. And now you realize that people all over the country were doing, they have hockey fight tapes. I wasn't a huge hockey fan, but I knew all the enforcers. Like McSorley, and this is like Jay Miller time, and Kordick.
Did you play a sport growing up?
Baseball, football, basketball.
Oh, wow.
We played everything, but what we played organized were those three.
Did you play in college?
I played baseball in college.
Oh, wow. You must have been good playing for Williams.
Williams is one step up from, I mean, athletically, it's like a high school all-star game. The guys, I didn't belong on that team. You know what happened was that I was a lefty, so my stock was automatically up a couple of points.
You were a pitcher?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they came to recruit me only because they recruited my brother, who was a senior when I was a freshman, and he was a phenomenal athlete. Phenomenal athlete. And they happened to come to one game, and I did really well in that one game, and they recruited me from there. My career was over before it started. I had back issues going back to when I was carrying that VCR around. So I sacrificed my athletic career.
You needed a steady cam in those days.
Oh my God. Yeah, seriously.
Listen, you said you're going to do a doc. You're working on a doc on me. We have you on again. We have a lot in common being from the same area, and we should just have you on again and just shoot the shit and do some more.
Yeah, once that thing is official.
Yeah, or even before, just to come on and hang out, you know?
Happy to do it.
The doc is on HBO right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's
HBO Go, HBO Now. I think it's showing on HBO, the main channel, but you can get it HBO, HBO Now whenever you want.
Yeah.
HBO Go, HBO Now.
And it's really, really, really well done, and it touches on a lot of great things. You learn a little bit about the wrestling world that you maybe didn't know and how it operates, but also you really get a window into this guy's life and what he was like as a real human being and not just this sort of carnival attraction, as you put it. Jason Hare, documentary filmmaker, Red Sox, Bruins, Celtics, Patriots fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to hate you for the rest. I'm going to hate you for the rest of your life because you shot basketballs from the parquet floor, not at any particular like at the height of being at the Garden at the height. Unbelievable. That's one of the things that before I die is I want me and my son is sit, right on the floor at at a Celtics. Guess people say it's like Avatar.
It's gone now though. The new place is fine, but even the mystique of that old place just felt like I think it was going.
I love the stories of like the Lakers complaining that they shut the AC off because Frank cranked the heat.
Yeah.
And Red Auerbach was just like a hard ball.
Well, there's this famous shot of Kareem on the sideline getting oxygen. We lost that series, but they did all they could. There's leprechauns all over the place.
Yeah, exactly. Red was one of them. Exactly. Hey, great to have you on. Let's get you on again, and we'll shoot the shit some more. Jason Hare, Andre the Giant documentary on HBO right now. Go watch it. It's really terrific. Thanks, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Jason Hare, how cool is that? I learned stuff about wrestling I didn't know it was regional. Really enjoyed having him on the show. I hope you enjoyed it. And this weekend, I'm going to be in Albany, New York, April 20th and 21st. And I'll be in Hartford, Connecticut, April 27th to the 29th. And come on out and check me there. And go to deepdiscount.com on my website. Click on that and pick up some cool stuff. Really cool t-shirts. Everything's great there. Cheap, cool. Get one. Something. Bye.